with Vice Chair Carpenter, Director Unsworth, Deputy Director Store. Commission, thank you for the opportunity to kind of talk to you a little bit about the effects of poaching today. We have a presentation for you, and I think you'll find it interesting. This is probably PG. There'll be some dead critters up here, so I'll give you a little bit of heads up right off the bat. So what is poaching? You know, when you look at the definition that you pull out of any dictionary, it really doesn't get it at what poaching means within a fish and wildlife community. This definition falls way short of what the agency believes is poaching. If you take into consideration back in the day of old English history, poaching and even the term game warden took on a different connotation. Game wardens were considered private employees for the most part, and they protected particular plots of land with particular landowners and sometimes group of landowners. And the North American model of conservation is clearly different than that, and it essentially says that the fish and wildlife belong to the citizens of the state, and you also need to have management practices that are built around sustainability. And poaching has a huge impact on sustainability, and we'll have some case examples as we go through this. We'll be able to explain how difficult it really is to reflect statistically, and we'll also show you some of the challenges that we have to meet our current mandate. So it's a complex environment. Capturing statistics, incidents, investigations, arrests, may paint those statistics may paint an untrue picture of poaching. Negative effects of population, ecosystems are delayed indicators that you may have already had your problem, and now it's time to figure out a way to address that problem. I think in most of the presentations that you hear here at the commission meetings, you'll recognize that there is definitely a component to nearly every management practice for enforcement. Some of the complex issues that you hear in rules, rule creation, we're the end user that actually has to implement them. And so those are definitely some challenges. Victimless crime. Essentially, you do have victims. It's you and me. It's the hunters and fishers of this state. But the actual death that occurs, the violation of management practices, that's the species. And species can't run down the local 7-Eleven, pick up a cell phone or the payphone, and report that their friend has just been killed. It's more of we look at the impacts going into a decline in populations. You have to be there in the first place, and that means that you have to, as an enforcement entity, deploy your people across the state in key locations in order to detect, arrest, investigate those crimes. And if you can't do that, that's where it falls into place, where you have officers that one officer per 46,000 people in the state. There's over 300,000 acres per fish and wildlife officer. We talk a lot about competing interests. Again, a lot of the management practices, the rules that you guys take a look at, well, those all have to be implemented by us. And it's not just the poaching. It's prevention, habitat destruction. All of those fall in our tool belt, and we have to carry out those missions. Measuring compliance is extremely difficult. There's regulatory complexity. There is every day there's changing strategies by those who violate the laws put in place to protect any given species. Overt presence as a deterrent, that becomes an issue when you don't have the resources to actually address any given instance. Jurisdictional complexity. We heard today that with the Halibut plan that, hey, it's not just somebody else's problem. It's all of our problem. When we're dealing with species that are migratory, it's everybody's problem. We have to be part of the solution on a grander scale. We deal with the complexity of intergovernmental work between the tribes, federal governments, and all have the authority to arrest, create rules. And so we have to be in that playing field as well. So when you start looking at our statistics, yes, by graph chart, they're pretty impressive. You can see there that total recreational fishing and hunting charges have been pretty cyclical. They seem to be on par. I can tell you for the 2015 statistics, there isn't much of a change. They still are trending that same way. On the commercial front, this is the commercial front that is more difficult, because some of those cases, those charges that are made, take months and months to create, to bring that investigation to fruition. And so when you have a drop in those numbers, doesn't necessarily mean that we're not doing our job. There's a whole host of external impact that could affect arrest numbers in that regards. Some of the statistics that we also keep on the commercial violations is again, that's a repeat slide, but the one that shows the top 10 counties. Again, if you take a look at Pierce County, you have a huge spike in 2012, and that's really not representative of really anything, because you could have one commercial violation case that has a whole host of small misdemeanor charges wrapped in it, and it isn't as significant as the four or five charges that are, end up on the felony side of the house that have huge impact to our resources. On the recreational fishing and hunting side, again, there's the top 10 counties within our state. Again, the statistics can skew or give you a false opinion of whether or not violations are high within a particular jurisdiction. Take a look at the fact that your top four, not necessarily Mason County, but your top four, King County, Pierce County, and Snohomish County is where your major population is. You have rich resource in terms of the crab fishery, salmon fishery. And we also, the other piece of that puzzle is the fact that we have our officers deployed fairly heavily along I-5. And there's a reason for that, because sometimes you're managing not only the species or fish and wildlife issues, but you're also managing human interaction. And so that is one of the reasons why we're deployed along the I-5 corridor so heavily. So I kind of alluded a little bit earlier about not all violations are equal. Telling the story is difficult. When violations occur, it doesn't necessarily account for the impact or the severity. And we again, are mixed into that goal of resource management and sustainability. And we all know that these are probably some of our top cases, spree killing, illicit markets, unaccounted for catch, and ecosystem destruction that account for many of our declines in population.
Before you leave that, are those dead cats?
No, those are seals.
It's a little small.
You just opened up a comment small. That I'm not
saying. Yeah, we net a few cats.
The bounty.
So talk a little bit about spree killing. Not everything in terms of the scope or problem can be measured. Imagine when you have one of these very significant spree killing events that occur right before or right after a Carlton Complex fire, and how quickly the decline in populations can occur with those type of events happening right after each other. It's one of those deals that we do. One of those investigations we do an extremely good job with, considering our resources. Our folks, when they get into a type of case like this, they have tremendous tenacity. They have the wherewithal. They serve search warrants. They go through different jurisdictions, counties, in order to get some of those search warrants, and at times have to work very closely with tribal enforcement in order to bring a case to fruition.
Chief, on spree killing, do they take the rack, or is it just killing for killing's sake, or do they take meat?
Well, this particular case that I'm going to right now is kind of illustrative of that. Many times they do not. They remove the head, and the rest of the animal goes to waste. This particular case that I'm showing right now happened in Okanagan County. In this case, it took over 2 months to bring the person to justice. There was a little bit on the statistics for this particular case. There were 10 trophy animals that were all killed. There was 9 mule deer and 1 whitetail deer of trophy quality, and every single one of them were killed, the heads removed, and the rest of the carcass went to waste. The reason why it took 2 months is because this guy was good. He did his activity under the cloak of darkness, using spotlights, and in one of the cases, he actually slipped up enough to where we got a good vehicle description, good suspect description, and it was just good, solid game warden work after that. Gooey duck is how we're funded for a lot of our support of the gooey duck patrols is through ALEA dollars. One point that I may have missed a little bit earlier is when we're talking about competing priorities, there really isn't a single funding source that we use for operations. It doesn't come with a performance expectation. There are performance measures for nearly everything. And ALEA dollars is another example of that. So in the gooey duck industry, there's tracks along the Puget Sound. As we all know, gooey ducks are long-lived. They're long-living species. Recovery rates are extremely important because it's an industry in and of itself auctioning off those tracks for harvest. And when a potential buyer is awarded a track, they're expecting that there's a harvestable amount of gooey duck to keep their business going. So in some situations, impacts can be huge when there's poaching that occurs within these tracks. The sample that I have here is as far as a recovery rate, impacts of not recovering lost opportunity to this track, a particular track in which we had a case. There's missing estimated biomass of 838,000 pounds based on DNR average auction price of $17.60 a pound. This equates to an opportunity lost to a revenue dollar amount of over $14.5 million. And so There's a lot of abuses within the geoduck harvesting industry where high grading occurs. A lot of that occurs underneath the ocean or water level, and it also occurs on the boats themselves, and we're all a part of that and doing the investigation piece on that. So, yes, particularly in the geoduck industry, if you have violations, if you have poaching that occurs, these animals are not going to recover, and they're certainly not going to recover at the rate that they believe they should have within the ALEA process. Another case example, you kind of heard a little bit a similar story today regarding halibut and caps. So whiting is the target fishery in which harvesters are going after that species, but there are a host of groundfish that are also protected, or excuse me, not protected, but are on a decline and are considered over-harvested. Whiting is commercially caught off the coast of Washington. There's a number of rockfish species, as I said before, that are overfished. And in this particular case, there was a cap put on the amount of bycatch associated with those rockfish. There was a host of rumors out there that essentially people were going over that cap and having a tremendous impact. My partner here, Deputy Chief Sensi, put together a plan that was West Coast centric, meaning that Washington, California, and Oregon put together an implementation or emphasis plan in which they watched this industry, this whiting fishing industry, for 5 days straight, 24 hours around the clock. There was some shenanigans in the middle of that fishery where at the fish processing plant there was a couple of forklifts scuttling off a few totes of rockfish to locations where really they didn't belong. But all in all, they were accounted for. As they got closer and closer to that cap, something odd happened. Off the coast of Long Beach, I believe the number was about 16,000 pounds, or excuse me, 3 tons of Whittle rockfish washed up on the shore. Flyover in that same area found that there was over an estimated 1,600 pounds additional floating out in the off the shores. Cameras that were placed on the boats to monitor those harvest practices were disabled, and all in all, that particular situation, that case alone, ended up shutting down the whiting fishery. And in addition to that, there were some improvements put in place. There for a while, there were human monitors placed on each one of those vessels, and that changed things considerably. The prosecutions took place, monitoring improved, and the industry ended up filing a formal complaint against us. But in the end, there were improvements made, and that fishery was able to stay open and hopefully impacting those recovery rates on the rockfish. So with nearly every effort that the agency has, and this is all about management practices, and enforcement has a role in every single one of those management practices, nearly. Talked a little bit earlier, some of you have seen this slide before, but it's important to point out that in 1993, there were over 165 field-deployed officers at time of merger. And as you move forward, the state's population increased by 20%, and our officers numbers have depleted by 20%. Those dots that turned red on the screen are a representative sample, if you will, of the officers that we lost in that amount of time frame. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. If you go back to Bonneville Power Association determining that they no longer have to fund enforcement efforts, that was 10 officers. And there's a host of other cost increases over the years. There was a decrease in general fund over the years. And so you end up having a map that looks a lot more like this these days. And as I've told you before, when we have that happen, we try and do some deployment engineering where when we have a retirement, we take an opportunity to move one of our officers in key locations where we do have some of these problems, and we make sure that those issues are being addressed. That's essentially what I have for you today on enforcement and poaching issues. Again, it's extremely difficult to prove whether you're being successful or not by statistics. We do know that there are a number of abuses out there that, left unchecked, have that impact. You get reduced opportunity from the public. The good, honest citizens that purchase their licenses do have a reduced opportunity if poaching runs rampant. We know that in the industry side of the house that the same is true, that if a fishery goes over its cap and we have to close down a fishing season, that affects livelihoods. And so keeping that common balance of good, solid enforcement, education, and follow through with solid cases, that has a tremendous impact on our ability to maintain and manage these resources.
Mr. Thornburg.
Going back to your map, there are holes that look like they're pretty much national or federal lands, Olympic National Park and,
sure,
and the Colville National Forest and that sort of thing. So they have enforcement staff. Can you talk a little bit about that and your relationship and any responsibilities in those areas?
So Olympic National Park would be something a little bit different in that, yes, they do have their own rangers within the boundaries of that park. Of course, you have two large tribal reservations, the Colvilles as well as the Yakimas, that have a pretty sizable land mass. They do have tribal enforcement. But that is generally, we have partners that are in the federal law enforcement side, but Fish and Wildlife may not actually be their mission. I would say there's a very limited amount of U.S. Forest Service law enforcement officers in the state. U.S. Fish and Wildlife is sparsely placed in this state. I believe that there's five for the entire state. NOAA has some special agents along the coastline, but I believe that four or five within in our state, and I think that also covers Oregon. So, we do receive some assistance, but I can assure you, Commissioner, that nobody is more poised to address the missions of protection in us, the state, than us. They are great partners, have great resources that we trade back and forth, but at the end of the day, we definitely have Washington State most at our heart.
Yeah, if you would go back to that map and the dropping off of officers, I think you were pointing out something very important that we heard from the stakeholders when we were developing the steelhead rules that we just adopted. They're very concerned out on the west end of the Olympic Peninsula about the loss of any stationed officers. And there's no simple solution because you take from one place a scarce resource and put it somewhere else, then you've got a problem. So in the document that we had presented about these larger, longer-term steelhead issues that should be addressed, that was one of the things the stakeholders wanted us to look at is enforcement and the sufficiency of enforcement. And I think what was so gratifying for me during that process on the Olympic Peninsula was that we really did get the message out to more people that we're strapped. We'd love to have more enforcement capability, but we just don't have the funding, or we're not prioritizing the funding in that direction because it takes away from other important parts of our mission. So I just wanted to point out that you brought up something very near and dear to my heart and very important. We don't have a solution for it at this point.
Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Commissioner Wecker's statement there. You know, as we went out on the Wild Futures public meetings and in the email comments, the need for a larger enforcement presence was, near the top of issues that people wanted to have addressed. And so it's very likely, as we think about next session and how we move those concerns forward, that we'll be looking to hunters and fishers for some more help to do some of this work. But it's probably not fair. It isn't fair for that to be our sole source. And so we'll be in discussions around general fund in an atmosphere where general fund's very tough to have. The enforcement program is over time being funded by a patchwork of funds, as our other programs are, which makes them vulnerable, and it's a lot more work for every dollar you get, et cetera. So we are going to try and address some of this issue as part of the Wild Futures piece, but it's going to be tough.
And the more people understand it, potentially the more support we're going to have in the legislature.
Director, did you?
No, Joe.
You covered that. Okay.
It's just, if I did have anything to say, it would be that not only are the officers doing law enforcement work, but they're involved in all parts of the fish and game work or fish and wildlife work. There are FACE for information education out there, too. And so, doing biological work as well. And, they're very popular with our public. Well, it's universal that they get really high marks on any time you do any kind of survey. Not only do people want more officers, but they enjoy the contacts they have with our officers.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that with Deputy Director Stewart's comments about bringing in support from fishers and other sportsmen, I think this is an area where the non-hunter, non-fisher group would also be an important constituency to seek assistance from.
That's a good point. I know that some states have VCOs, volunteer conservation officers, that assist. A two-part question. Is that a value, and do we have anything or have we had anything like that to augment?
Thank you for that question, Chair. Yes, there are a number of states that have the reserve-type program. One of the things that is very difficult about a reserve-type program is liability, increased costs of outfitting our volunteers. it can be a nightmare in and of itself. I can speak from experience that when I was a City of Wenatchee police officer years ago, that the world was a lot less complex in the city of Wenatchee. But when you get into this world of fish and wildlife where there are just a ton of rules, regulations that have to be put into effect in order to protect particular species, and that knowledge base is so tremendous that I worry sometimes about even thinking about having a reserve program from that standpoint. And let's not forget, reserves require a tremendous amount of upkeep. They have to be keep up their training just as much as we have with our officers. And that in and of itself, I could have another presentation that I think you would find interesting. But if you took our officer time and you put it into a pie chart, you know, most people work about 1,700 hours within a given year, and our officers work 2,232 hours within a year because we work 171 hours versus 160 hours per 28-day period. But if you start looking at that pie chart and carving off what they have to do for administrative duties, what they have to carve off for training, because remember, our officers don't have backup for the most part. They're in remote locations. They need to have that winning attitude, and they have to win every single time if they are challenged by a would-be criminal that wants to hurt them. And so that training becomes extremely important. So if you carve off all of the training that goes in that this guy puts together for market emphasis, the training that this guy puts together for the trawl fishery, you start pulling off a whole lot of hours out of that expendable time that our officers can be in the field. And I'm not so sure that a reserve type program would augment or offset that. Thanks.
Yes.
Is the Eyes in the Woods program still operating, and perhaps you could explain that a little bit so that the chair understands?
So Eyes in the Woods is still active. I think they've shrank in focus over the years. Used to be that, you have to look at Eyes in the Woods. Eyes in the Woods was designed to help enforcement, but their main mission was to open up land to the individual hunter and the individual fisherman. And so they entered into a lot of agreements with private industrial timber companies to do cleanups, do biological work for the agency, and have check stations. Particularly one of the biggest ones was right outside of Vail Tree Farm outside of Olympia. And so, yes, they're still active. They help out in respects to putting up trail cameras in problem locations where some of these private industrial companies that are keeping their gates open to the public, they're helping that problem of solving that problem. But as far as another component to Eyes in the Woods was a court process where they're teaching citizens to be good witnesses. And it's citizen observation and report training. And that is beneficial. Certainly having another set of eyes from the public out in the woods certainly benefits us by the amount of calls that we get and when that starts an investigation. But Eyes in the Woods volunteers have fallen off a little bit. I think there's been some change within the leadership. Quite frankly, at my headquarters level, I've got a capacity issue too, where I would love to have a coordinator that could work with a volunteer group like that, but expending that type of time is very difficult.
I know there was, for a period, there were regular training sessions available. Mm-hmm. And when I think of Eyes in the Woods, I think of the component you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. More than one enforcement officer has told me the most valuable tools available now is a cell phone and a video camera. And now they're building to one. Mm-hmm. And so What the Eyes in the Woods made available to the department were people in the field that were trained in a non-confrontational way of observing and reporting violations. They didn't want them to make a citizen's arrest. They just wanted them to document a license plate and maybe the kill or violation, and without ever confronting the violator. And there was, I thought, some positive elements to that program. And and you're right, it has fallen off. And so I don't know, because it's a lack of perceived value of the program, or it seems to me if there was a value to the program, it would have a higher priority, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I could speak to a little bit about that. I used to be in charge of the liaison work between Eyes in the Woods, but actually when we did, when I was promoted to chief and we did some restructuring at headquarters, I think honestly that piece of it may have fallen off somebody's plate. Absolutely see value to that. The other piece is that making open doors for people to report violations. We have a texting text a violation where people can actually do like you were saying, Commissioner, and taking pictures of the violation, and they can literally text it to our WildCom, our communication center, and that information can be quickly sent out to the field. There is a host of really neat ideas. Every time that we go to OFWA or WAFWA, we pick up another trick of the in the Game Warden book of tricks. And some of that is really that outreach, Operation Game Theft. For us, it's Turn in a Poacher. Those pieces are hugely valuable, and it's a way of reaching out to the public, and they feel good about the fact that they're able to help us in our efforts.
Yeah. I'm aware of a program called RAP, Report All Poaching, that they put that the call-in number all over the place, with posters. And that enabled a lot of people. It was one call in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to build a little bit on what the chief had to say there. You still need someone to respond at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah, right.
And the chief has been working to restructure our records management system so we better capture what our calls for service are. We don't have a super great handle on that right now. We know there's volume there. But that probably isn't going to be representative of what you could get from the citizenry in terms of tips and information. Really, our best cases come from members of communities that you have a presence in. And you develop that trust relationship, and they call you in the middle of the night, and they turn someone in that, you know, they're going to encounter, and, you know, they really don't want that to impact their personal life. And so, I mean, not to overemphasize the presence thing, but it all boils down to having enough folks to be able to interact with our partners so we can give them a meaningful service. And what Kyle does is very important, and we've always embraced it. But we feel quite badly that we're juggling so many balls now that a few are dropping on the floor, and that's likely one of them.
I just wanted to say I've had a good fortune to work with Lee Davis. He's with Eyes in the Wood in Ellensburg, and then my organization and Mueller Foundation, we teamed up to help generate the interest for some Eyes in the Woods trainings. And let's see, I think Clallam had 30 people turn out. I think Winthrop had 20. Just once we had 30. OMAC we had 30. Colville about 25. Republic 2. But there was a big thunderstorm that night. but in all cases, I mean, it was pretty much a phone call to the officers to see if they could do it, and they were there. You know, so I think it helped having some teamwork and some collaboration to help set up the crowd to come. And I think that was one of the things they always mentioned was it had kind of reached a point where they'd hold the trainings, but not enough people would show up, you know, to make it all worthwhile. And so they were really thankful, I think, for that support. But the best part of all those trainings was the 30 or so people at each one, you know, making sure they knew their law enforcement officer. And the stories that got told were just, you know, really, really amazing. And I think most people didn't realize all the poachers that were being caught and all the poaching going on and all the violations. And so really good process. And every time we held one, it was just really super for the community involvement with these officers, and they did great jobs.
Great. Thank you.
Any last questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen. I think you...
We got suspension revocation piece.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thank you in advance. Anyway. The appreciation's already there.
Commission, in 2003, the legislature overhauled our commercial license suspension process. The past scheme was fairly simple. Memory serves me right. It was 3 violations in a 5-year period, and you were suspended for a year in whatever license area that you violated. And so post-2003, only certain violations qualified. And then there was an appeal layer that was developed called the License Suspension Committee. And the committee's purpose essentially was to hear any extenuating circumstances that a commercial fisherman might have had that might not be otherwise considered. Let's face it, there are some challenges that commercial fishermen have that you have to be sympathetic to. I mean, I would hope that we don't. I hope we mete out the proper amount of justice given the set of circumstances, but you know, you can be lawfully gill netting and get into a bunch of dogfish and find yourself. I mean, I jumped on a gill netter's boat that the poor guy was almost in tears because he had 500 dogfish in his net and he was picking like crazy, but he was an hour past the closure. You know, we get that. So there are some challenges that they face, and so it's a pretty serious matter to suspend somebody's ability to make a living, and this is not a bad idea. The problem is it's never been implemented, and so we've been trying to put this thing together, and I think we're well on our way to doing that. So. Just to give you some background based on current law, the director may suspend for a year if you're convicted of 2 or more qualifying commercial violations within a 3-year period under this model. The director can refer a person for suspension if convicted of 1 qualifying violation. So we're talking about a subset of violations that qualify for suspension, whereas in the past, everything counted. If that violation is of severe magnitude. I feel like some edits may have eliminated a bullet, but that's not defined. If I were to redo this slide right now, I'd add one more. The director can refer one egregious shellfish violation, and that is defined, and that's defined as a possession violation involving possession of a product where you violated size, sex, species by 20 or more percent of what was allowed, over and above what was allowed. So 20%, 21% of your delivery of Dungeness crab are undersized, as an example. The director could refer that single event to the committee. And so the suspended person may appeal to the committee. So just because the director suspends a commercial fisher that fits within these guidelines doesn't mean that there's an automatic appeal to this committee. the individual has to request it, although the director can request it as well, or he can just summarily suspend.
Got it.
Oh, sorry, boss. The committee itself is made up of 5 voting members and up to 4 alternates. 3 must be commercial license holders or peer group members. Got some definition from the, or an interpretation from the Attorney General's office with respect to what a peer group member is. I was a little concerned that a peer was a commercial crab fisherman and a commercial crab fisherman, having to sit in judgment of somebody that has the same license type that you have, and that's not their perspective. It's a commercial fisherman that happens to hold a license. No 2 voting members may be from the same county. That's a bit constraining. And 2 must be appointed. 2 may be appointed by the director and may be DFW employees. Somebody really butchered my slide here. It wasn't the chief. Three are appointed by, that number's not here, but 3 are appointed by the commission. 2 are appointed by the director. There's a 2-year renewable term. Commission may develop minimum member standards. And then a decision has to be rendered within 3 months of the appeal or referral from the department, in this case the director. The director shall consider the committee's opinion, and he might issue the suspension, he might not issue it, or he might modify it based on what was learned in that hearing. So, the committee may believe that some sanction is in order, but it shouldn't be a year. Maybe it's 6 months. Maybe it's 3 months, as an example. But at the end of the day, the director can fully implement the recommendations or ignore them. And a majority vote is required, and alternates may vote as well if one of the committee members isn't able to vote. For some reason, they have to leave early, as long as the alternate, of course, heard all the testimony. So where are we right now? We sent a letter out to industry. The director did that a couple of months ago, sir. And we were soliciting participants' interest. We heard crickets, so we started making some phone calls. And you should be seeing 5 applications. Tammy, I don't know if you received all 5 yet. All you have is 5. It's not a pool to choose from. We had to work hard to find individuals that were willing to sit in judgment of their peers. I mean, that's a hard thing to do. It's a big thing to ask, but they were willing to do that. I don't anticipate that we're going to have very many suspensions when I think about the commercial violations over the last decade and who was involved. There might be 4 to 6 individuals that would have been suspended. I don't want to make it seem like folks have been getting away with a lot. We have some powerful tools. One of them is vessel seizure and potential forfeiture. So you tie a purse seiner up that has a 24-hour opportunity to make his or her bread and butter, that's a big deal. The bond is $100,000 to get that vessel out of hock unless you settle with the department. And so the time that you're spent being tied up at the dock plus whatever monetary, settlement or conclusion comes out of that seizure forfeiture, that's a big impact. And you don't have to do that very often to get people's attention. And I remind everybody here that many of our major poachers don't have a license to lose.
Right.
nothing to suspend. That concludes this briefing, sir.
I'm safe now thanking you.
You can thank me before, during, or after. All three would be great.
Oh, well done, gentlemen. Any other questions from the commission? I think I speak for all of us. Just, you know, we're here to help you. So, I mean, I think we all get it. And we're all, I wouldn't say sympathetic is the appropriate word, but we're understanding. It's our collective goal to make things better for you.
Well, I don't think that, I mean, we have a lot of robust discussions, but trying to figure out how to measure the impact of poaching.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's daunting. You know, there's some isolated areas where you can measure the behavior. I mean, that's the first thing you have to be able to measure. I mean, what happens when you're not there? So if you can measure the behavior, the impact's a little easier to measure, but not always. It may not be immediate. It may be cumulative. And you just got lucky.
And Commissioner Thornburg has something. I think she hit on a really good point that this could be, in a roundabout way, a unifier to with the diversity folks and the hunting fishers out there, that this is an abhorrent crime against the people of the state of Washington. So I think.
Thank you, Chair. And there again, this gets to be a little nitpicky because last year down home we had two bull elk shot and they taken, I don't know, maybe a hind quarter or two off one of the bulls and left the others, cut the heads off. And needless to say, they weren't Einsteins that did it and got to bragging and got caught. And it was kind of ended up the worst kept secret in the county, but it was a long time before. Because Matt Sabo had done the work and ended up with a really good bust, and these guys were serial poachers and everything else. And it just seemed like it took forever to get out to where it was public. And to me, as an officer, to do a really good job like that and then not get any recognition for it seemed like forever. And by the, yeah, it was, it just, for morale end point, you when you see somebody do a really good job, you like to compliment them. And there again, it came down, oh, they're building a case. But, you know, when it's somebody gets murdered in town, you find out the names and what went on in pretty short order. So.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And in that particular case, our officers were extremely creative. Initially, they didn't want to release some of the details because they thought they might have had another suspect in mind, but when that dried up and they started using social media as an outlet to generate response from the public, that's what really broke the case loose. And you're right, in that particular serial poaching incident, not only were Washington State cases cleared up, but the state of Idaho, right across the river, solved multiple bighorn sheep violations as well as elk and deer on their side of the river. So creative folks. I mean, our guys could, I swear, make a nuclear bomb out of matchsticks, but they're creative folks, and they do an incredible job, and I can't say enough about them. You've got some really solid performers down in your neck of the woods.
Talking about eyes in the woods. In our part of the world, since they started offering bonus points for when you turn in a poacher, there are people that turn in their mother for not an elk draw in our part of the world. So
we like that.
Yeah.
Did you? Commissioner Mackin.
Yeah, I have talked with both of you, and you know what my concerns are. My concerns are related to the conservation of the resources. And I know that you two are very, and your officers are really attuned into that. Most biological models that determine what harvestable surplus is have to do with a function called mortality. And, you know, I know that even in fisheries, it's difficult to come up with a good mortality figure. But my hope was that in your presentations you would get to that point. My expectation was that you would have no answers to that. In other words, being able to come up with a good figure for mortality, which has to be subtracted right off the top when you're looking at harvestable surplus. So, yeah, Mike.
Yes, we're sorry to disappoint. We really grappled with this, but you know, when we're trying to find 3 B-run steelhead to prosecute, you know, a fishery below Bonneville, 3 fish, and somebody goes, "Eureka, we found them." You know, a decimal point got moved, and I mean, I'm not, you know, and now we have 3 fish.
Yeah.
I think to myself, 1 gill net set during the close season, and there's no wiggle room. There's no surplus. You went beyond what the TAC was, which is based on 100% compliance, essentially. And in the case example involving the whiting fishery, there are all these rebuilding plans for, at the time, 7 overfished rockfish populations that were based on decades of recovery. And these folks, I mean, it went beyond just discarding at sea. They were grinding them up at the dock and the whole bit, and blew well beyond the cap, which, if it would have gone unbridled, likely could have set rebuilding back decades for that particular population of rockfish. And, you know, some of the caps or tax or limits on our critters have been down to a tenth of a ton. And you just, you know, we think, gosh, all you need is half a dozen cheaters, and you've set back whatever the conservation goal was pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
It's just hard for us to measure that.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
I think a hope that most people would recognize that whatever percentage of the mortality rate, poaching is never an acceptable portion of that percentage. But there are models out there, and looking and doing my research on this, there are studies that have been done across the state. There's been some out of the state of Oregon. But where those studies actually get into some hard figures are when you're talking about a specific GMU and not necessarily a statewide population of elk or population of deer. It's smaller geographical locations. It's an identified and defined number of known killed animals through the practice of poaching. But as Mike says, this kind of blew our minds a little bit on thinking about how do you statistically prove you're being successful, and that's what we kind of boiled it down to, because we do. We regularly look at statistics and say, okay, this is our report card, yes or no. Not really. It doesn't show the full picture of our effort, and it doesn't show the full picture of where we're not successful because we don't have enough people in those particular spots. Not being there is not necessarily an impact one way or the other, but we do know that those violations will have a higher rate of occurrence if we're not. So that's kind of some of what we boiled it down to. Kind of a funny story, though. I started asking a lot of people that I'd met in shopping centers and my wife's friends. I started asking them, just kind of all walks of life people, what's poaching to you? And the most notable definition that I got from poaching is my daughter attends a Western Washington University. I'll keep the name out of it. It's not Western Washington University. I'll just say that, but a Western Washington University. And I asked one of her roommates, my daughter fishes, and she wants to get into hunting, but not so much on her roommate's side. But I asked her roommate, what does poaching mean to you? And just like that, she said, isn't that where you take an egg and put it in hot water? And so, you know, you kind of, you've got all over the board for what it means to the common citizen poaching, and then trying to narrow it down to how effective are you as an enforcement program in combating it. That's a bumpy road.
You know, on that, I lived in England for a few years, and in a rural part of England, and the poacher historically was a hero because he stole from the king, and it was in the Robin Hood vein.
Yep. You know,
the person that got the poacher was the bad guy, and it was just kind of a, you know, it flips around. Any last?
Yeah.
Yes.
Was thinking about, you know, how do we define poaching as a conservation issue? How do we describe whether poaching has risen to the level of conservation problem? And I remember it's been a number of years since we had our enforcement committee meeting in which you described to us poaching in the Upper Columbia River, the salmon incident case. I'm not sure whatever happened, but that was a very clear example to me where I think, I don't remember exactly what you said, but it was something on the order that the illegal take is similar to or exceeds the legal take. And to that, to me, that's one of the examples, one of the stark examples. If that is happening in a number of places, you don't have to prove it statewide. You have shown that it can be an enormous conservation concern if it's more than what the legal harvest is. So can you correct anything I said that was inaccurate?
Sturgeon, too.
Thank you, Commissioner Wecker. I'll tell you what happened to the case and go from there. Nothing. Nothing happened to the case. Local prosecutor wouldn't touch it. The feds wouldn't touch it. So we're going to work it through the U.S. v. Oregon process. I don't know what that gets us at the end of the day.
How long ago was this? We're talking 5 years, four or five years?
It's about a five-year-old case. Maybe four or five. We've had some other instances, too, similar, but not the same scale. But essentially, 1 million pounds of salmonids that were never accounted for and were not figured into the mortality impact on ESA-listed species, the impacts that, you know, that we modeled. So we exceeded our impact rates on a number of species. And particularly with respect to steelhead, you know, the illegal harvest exceeded what was reported. So, you know, I mean, you have to be careful in terms of the location where this event occurred to not be missing some sampling approach that might capture the harvest. But I can tell you that the investigative lead in that case, Sergeant Wickersham, he was really careful about looking at how we measure harvest there, whether that harvest had been captured in some other way, you know, comparing that to sort of the year-end conclusion with respect to reported harvest. And we're pretty confident with our numbers, but you're all aware there's other implications, you know, with a case like that. And we could certainly share the details, but the complexity of fish management, along with other factors and intimidation at the prosecutor's level in terms of complexity, dissuaded us from being able to pursue anything. And we've got some mechanical issues that need to be fixed as well. Spoke with Director Unsworth about this. He was quite interested in, you know, understanding how catch is accounted for. And we've got a very dated catch accounting model. It's a paper model. We walked into a fish company a couple of weeks ago and found 100,000 pounds of gooey duck on paper that had never been reported to the state. So somebody bought a tract at auction that had 100,000 pounds less gooey duck than they thought they were buying. I'm over-dramatizing. Probably it wasn't that great of an impact, but just so you can imagine it. And so fish tickets had been completed, but they hadn't been turned in. And trust me, it was intentional in that case. It wasn't an accident. It involved a company that has intentionally misreported or underreported in the past. And how is that not a red flag when you've got this chunk of fish tickets in a series that's missing? And our staff, you know, and the program that manages all that, it's all they can do to keep punching the information. You know, we don't have the resources within the agency to even manage that clunky, archaic paper system. So we need to go electronic, and it's going to make a big difference in terms of detecting abuses. We have companies that have drawn fish receiving tickets, books, they've been issued, and they've gone out of business, and we don't know it. We have rules that require them to notify us of that and turn in the unused books, but nobody has the time to follow that up. So one of the greatest causes, I think, to undermining conservation is rules, regulations that are violated that pertain to harvest accounting, whether it's, you know, big game or it's our, you know, food fish populations. We don't know what's being taken out of the, you know, out of the environment. Then how can you manage sustainably?
Any last comments or questions? Seeing none, a final then. Thank you.